forever chemicals are substances that sort of don't break down in the environment, or if they do, it might take tens of thousands of years, or maybe they won't at all. PFAS are a group of those forever chemicals, and they're about, at the last guess, somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 of them.
If you think of anything that's heat-proof, grease-proof, waterproof, it may very well be likely to contain PFAS. That could be your takeaway food boxes, your non-stick cookware, your sofa, which may have flame retardant sprayed on it, some of your waterproof clothing, for example, your makeup potentially. It's in rivers, waterways, tap water. It's in the rain. It's been called the poison of the century. But even if we stop producing PFAS right now, the cost of decontamination is going to be about $4 billion every year for the next 20 years across the UK and Europe.
Forever chemicals, or PFAS. We hear about them a lot. And if you're anything like me, you might be worried about reports that they're seeping into everything. And if they are seeping into everything, it would be good to know about the impacts on our health and the environment. So I put a call out to Guardian readers and on our community tab on YouTube, and we had over 150 responses. So there's a lot of people out there that feel this way too. So today I'm putting these questions to two people who have worked tirelessly to raise awareness about the impact of these chemicals, Liana Hosea and Rachel Salvage, who together have formed Watershed Investigations, a non-profit which works to shine a light on the water crisis in its many forms.
Hi, Liana. Hi, Rachel.
Hey.
Hi, Josh.
How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for joining me and for being here. Rachel, could you try and define what forever chemicals are?
Forever chemicals are substances that sort of don't break down in the environment, or if they do, it might take tens of thousands of years, or maybe they won't at all. And PFAS are a group of those forever chemicals, and they're about, at the last guess, somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 of them. So huge numbers of them. And what makes them forever chemicals is that they've got this really, really strong carbon-fluorine bond, which you just can't break. So that's brilliant for industry and all these products. It's sort of a wonder chemical, the Teflon chemical. But obviously that's bad because it gets into the environment and in habitats, and for humans, because PFAS builds up in water, it builds up in soils, it builds up in wildlife and in the body. You can't break it down very easy. You don't metabolize it very easily, so it builds up. And also, when it's in the food web, it sort of bioaccumulates up to the top of the food web. So if you're a bird of prey or a marine mammal or something at the top of the chain, and you're eating animals that have been ingesting PFAS on the way up, then you get a huge load when you have your dinner at the top. So they are man-made chemicals, and they continue to be made today, even though a couple of them have been banned already because we know that they're toxic. There are many, many more out there, and we really don't know what the toxic impacts of them because the studies haven't been done yet. Is that too rambling?
That was great. Really concise. No, perfect. I mean, it's a lot to explain.
Yeah,
they're quite complex things, aren't they?
You can imagine the problem. If there are 15,000 of these chemicals, and public interest science takes like a couple of decades to prove that this substance is so bad that it has to be banned, only two or three are banned and regulated, that it's not possible for science to keep up with the manufacturers, who can do little things like tweak a molecule, rename it and send it out again. So this is kind of game of whack-a-mole that science can't keep up with, which is why the European Union is talking about regulating them all as one class, because they can't keep up otherwise. And then the industry is fighting really hard the other way to say you can't do that because you're going to cause economic chaos and all this kind of stuff. So it's that kind of thing. It's a really problematic chemical. We only know a lot about a very small number of them, but there are thousands out there. So it's really, really problematic.
So I've put a call out for readers to ask questions that they might have about PFAS that I could potentially put to you guys. One of them that kept coming up was, why do these things exist to begin with? But if they're such a dangerous chemical, then why have they been allowed to kind of enter into our industries?
I think because they have these amazing properties. If you think of anything that's heat-proof, grease-proof, waterproof, it may very well be likely to contain PFAS. So that could be your takeaway food boxes, like pizza boxes, your non-stick cookware, your sofa, which may have flame retardant sprayed on it, some of your waterproof clothing, for example. So it could be all around in, you know, your makeup, potentially some of the plastic bottles that you might use in your shampoo might have it. Firefighting foams, so because they're heat proof, you know, it's brilliant at putting out fires, so that's why they've been used and kind of rolled out across industrial processes and consumer goods in rivers, waterway, tap water. It's in the rain. Recent scientific reports have said we've actually reached this planetary boundary. You know, we produce so much of it and it's building up in our environment so much that, you know, it's going to start to impact Earth systems. Because, yeah, it doesn't break down naturally.
So, for instance, if we kind of on a personal level, if I'm wearing a waterproof jacket or if I'm using, say, a nonstick pan, what kind of health concerns would I need to worry about? Are these long-term things, are these short-term things in terms of health problems? Can you break that down for me?
Your jacket, and when you're wearing it, it's not really going to, I mean, it can, there is a problem with dermal contact, but obviously when you wash your jacket, more parts of the PFAS might break up in your washing machine and they'd go out into the environment. It might be, you know, it's on various kind of, within your home, it'll be on various consumer goods, on your sofa, so there might be dirt kind of on the floor. And so children have been, you know, could be potentially at kind of like, kind of a more sensitive to some of those harmful effects. Because they've got smaller bodies, so they can, you know, exposure could mean more. You might be crawling around on the dirt, picking stuff up, putting it in their mouths, as well as, you know, getting it from breast milk or from inside the womb. So there's lots of paths of exposure and different ways of exposure, as well as through your drinking water, food as well. And so that it's that idea of that it accumulates and over time, you know, it can build up. And if you're constantly sort of exposed by many different sources, it can become problematic.
Could you give some of those examples and how the different health problems that can arise from PFAS exposure?
The research is still ongoing, but what they have shown is that it can increase your risk of certain cancers like prostate, kidney or testicular cancer. Has reproductive effects like decreased fertility or increased high blood pressure in women, pregnant women, developmental effects and delays in children like low birth weight or accelerated puberty. Also the reduced ability of your immune systems to fight infections, which might look like reduced vaccine response. Interference with the body's natural hormone system and also increased cholesterol levels and risk of obesity.
Yeah, it's a long list, isn't it?
It is a long list. I haven't mentioned all of them. But the way that it impacts us, you know, is also different. There's new research out which shows sort of your genes and your genetic variations could play a part in how you might be impacted, your age and so forth. So, you know, it's still really, the science is still kind of developing, but I think there is a consensus that it is a health problem. It's been called the contamination, you know, the poison of the century, the most important kind of, you know, contamination crisis that we're facing in the world.
So there's bigger risks, obviously, with food and water, because that's something we consume constantly. And you're saying that builds up. So, but we don't have to be immediately alarmed by just putting on our jacket. We're not going to contract something horrible.
You're not going to immediately die. No,
okay, it's
like you might be more susceptible. You might be more susceptible. So, for example, at low levels, your immune system response, immunotoxicity. So, you might be less. You know, vaccines might be less efficacious. Might work less well, and you might get ill more. So. You know, certain diseases, it might, you know, increase your likelihood of that. So you might not necessarily die of, you're not going to die of PFAS, but it might, you know, create these changes in your body, which can lead to these sort of diseases.
Rachel, Liana mentioned some of these acute exposures, for instance, the firefighting foam.
With some of the major sources where you're going to get, you can get a lot of PFAS pollution, range from military bases where they've used these firefighting foams in huge volumes because there's PFAS in the firefighting foams. Same for commercial airports and smaller airports. Those are big pollution zones. Manufacturing plants where they either manufacture the PFAS or they use it a lot. The AGC Chemicals plant in the Northwest They produce a lot of it. That's where we found huge concentrations, really high concentrations in their effluent. And that's where the Environment Agency, the UK Health Security Agency and the Council are now all testing around that area. Metal plating plants, paper mills and pulp mills, they use a lot because a lot of packaging materials have the coating on them that's PFAS. Landfills, so a lot of the waste, any of the things that we've talked about, whether it's an industrial waste or whether it's consumer waste, goes into landfills, has PFAS on it, can leach out. Wastewater treatment works, so all the water is draining in from domestic and industrial waste, goes into the wastewater treatment works. Often they can't remove it straight out into the rivers. And then the sewage sludge that is made from that treatment process, so the water will go out to the river or treated and back into the system. And then the horrible gunk that you're left with is called sewage sludge. Often that's full of PFAS and microplastics and terrible things too. It does get treated, but those things won't get removed. And then that goes to be spread on agricultural land. So fields are also, you know, they can be sources of pollution because it can run off into the rivers. It can get into the food chain that way. So there are a lot of these potential big sources as well as the smaller consumables.
I think the Environment Agency had a report which said over 10,000 potential problem sites across the UK.
So if you're living anywhere near those or consuming things from those areas, then you might be getting contaminated.
A higher hit, yeah. Yes.
There are problems of resourcing in the UK. The Environment Agency's had its budget slashed year on year on year on year. And if they go looking for something like that, then they're going to have to do something about it. And there are really no resources to fix it. We wrote a story fairly recently where we'd seen emails between the EA and DEFRA talking about the small number of hotspots that have been identified to date. And they were kind of throwing their hands up in the air, saying they were worried about how much it was going to cost because they couldn't afford the investigations into these places, let alone the actual cleanup. So it's going to be a big problem. And I guess they thought if, you know, nobody had flagged it, then maybe it wasn't a problem here, but that would be quite far-fetched, maybe.
Yeah, the costs are just huge. As again, with the Forever Pollution Project team, we really investigated and worked out with a whole bunch of academics, scientists and other journalists how much, you know, this could actually cost to clean up this forever chemical. And we worked out it was £1.6 trillion across the UK and Europe over a 20-year period if we don't do anything about it. But even if we stop producing PFAS, right now the cost of decontamination is going to be about £4 billion every year for the next 20 years across the UK and Europe.
And those costs don't take into account cost of illness that might occur, you know, public health issues that might occur as a result. So that's just the cleanup. So the acceptable level for PFAS in drinking water in the UK is fairly high. It's around 100 nanograms per litre, roughly. I won't go into the details of it. But in the US, it's at 4 nanograms per litre. And it wasn't that long ago that in the UK, what is now 100 was 10,000 nanograms per litre. That was like in 2005, roughly. So there was an enormous fire in Bunsfield near St Albans in the oil depot. They poured almost the entire country's supply of this firefighting foam on the depot to put it out. It's above a drinking water aquifer, so that all got contaminated. And from then on, the acceptable limit started to come down. So what we have here now at 100 nanograms per litre is not really very strict. And if you lived in Denmark, it would be 2 nanograms per litre. So there's a push from the RSC, the Royal Society of Chemistry, and a lot of experts for the government to reduce those limits, which they are looking at, and I presume they will be doing at some point. But then that's a problem for the water companies, because they then have to have the technology to be able to reduce those limits. And it's not the water company's fault. They're just, you know, they're just receiving this water. So it's a really difficult situation. But I think regulation needs to be tighter to protect public health.
That's an important point, I think, to maybe underline, is that it's not the water companies that are putting this stuff into the water. They're not necessarily responsible for the contamination, is that right?
That's correct. I mean, in one of the stories that we wrote, we were talking to Water UK, which represents the water sector, and they came out and said they want to see a ban on PFAS because it's going to be too difficult for them to deal with. If they see these limits drop, they're going to have to spend billions, which they don't have. And obviously, there's the whole problem with water sector financing anyway in this country. So it's a really, really difficult point. However, wastewater treatment plants can actually convert some substances via their processes into PFASs. When you get into the chemistry of it, it's really difficult. And then those PFASs get out into the rivers. And some wastewater treatment plants, when they receive the waste, they don't have the technology to take the PFAS out anyway, so it goes into the rivers. And it may even go into the sludge, which then gets spread onto farmland as nutrients, and then could potentially get into the food chain that way or wash off into the rivers again. So the whole system is kind of inundated with PFAS, and it's really hard to say what should happen, except the manufacturers potentially ought to be responsible because they're making a fortune from it, and we are essentially having to deal with their waste at this end, which can't be right.
Yeah, because most wastewater treatment plants don't have the filtration system that can take PFAS and these complex chemicals out, and they want sort of a polluters pay law, kind of similar to one that was passed in the EU, so you could get, you know, these industrial kind of polluters to help pay, I suppose, for the upgrades that all of the water companies are going to need, because as Rachel was saying, it's the sewage outflows which are also sources of PFAS pollution, even if it's treated. It just can't be filtered out at this point. So it's in the tap water at, you know, and it's in the raw water at high levels. And what most of the water companies are doing is diluting the water with clean water, which doesn't have much PFAS in. So they're staying below that regulatory sort of 100 mark.
But one water company was saying, yes, we can blend the contaminated water with cleaner water to bring it down. However, all our sources have PFAS in it to some level. Right. So finding that cleaner water is getting harder. And with climate change, if you're having a drought, there's less water anyway, and those concentrations are going to increase. So it's just, you know, the pinch points, the problem is just going to get more and more difficult as we go forward if we don't turn the tap off at the other end, at least for those inessential PFAS uses.
I think a lot of people will listen to this, especially a lot of the things that you've mentioned about water contamination, and they might think, oh, maybe it's bad to drink tap water, and maybe bottled water is better. What would you say to people that might make that assumption?
Yeah, I don't think bottled water is better, because obviously it's in plastics, and there might be all sorts of chemicals in plastics which can leach off into your drinking water, especially when it's in the sun. You know, there might be contaminants in the source itself. I would say, you know, if you are very concerned, potentially, you know, you could always put your own water filter in your house. But, you know, the UK do have, you know, they are keeping limits under a certain level.
Exactly. It completely depends on, you know, where they've taken it from. If they're taking it from the same drinking water aquifer that's, you know, near an MOD base or whatever it is, then it's going to have the same amount as the stuff that comes into the your normal drinking water supply. So, and then you have to rely on the treatment processes of whichever bottler, whichever company is using that water. So it's a real unknown. We don't know. I wouldn't say it was any better. I wouldn't suspect that it would be.
You mentioned the UK threshold for what's acceptable limits is far above what the US has put in place and the EU, is that right?
Yeah,
we really have been behind the US and the Europe in terms of safeguarding drinking water with these low limits. We've been behind in understanding the scale of contamination in the UK because we're still finding out today, and we're behind in the regulation. So in terms of what the EU is thinking about doing is regulating these 10,000-15,000 was one class, so they can at least have some control over where it goes. And here there's nothing like it, and we're not aligning at all on that level. There is some action into sort of taking some PFASs out of firefighting foams, and some, I think they were looking at some cosmetics or something like that, but very sort of low level stuff.
Although there is a bit of a Trump effect. So President Trump has sort of rescinded a proposed law which was going to set national limits on the chemicals coming out of the effluent. So now it's going to be up to individual states to kind of regulate the pollution on their own. There won't be federal laws on that. And he's also looking to kind of weaken some of the state laws on regulating PFAS. I would say France at the moment is kind of a leader really in regulating PFAS. You know, they kind of put a ban on PFAS in specific products, which comes into effect next year, apart from cookware. And you know, it's going to be, you know, mandatory, more testing and so forth. So they've really kind of been blazing the way in regulating PFAS.
Is there any sliver of hope in this coverage, or, you know, is there anything that people can cling to?
Yeah, I think that there are some things to be positive about. So we know from our work that the Environment Agency and other agencies are spending quite a lot of time and resource now trying to work out where the contamination is. They're prioritising sites and more monitoring is being done and action is happening. So that's something to be happy about. But another good piece of news is that on the 10th of April, the Environmental Audit Committee, which is a parliamentary select committee, is going to launch an inquiry into PFAS, into the contamination, into how we're regulating here, whether that's enough and what needs to be done to get it under control. So that's going to shine a big light on it. So that's really great news too.
You spoke about how the companies producing these chemicals could play a bigger role in preventing them from just entering our water chain. Can governments put pressure on them to do that?
I think laws work. So, you know, and litigation is obviously working. You've got the chemical giant 3M, one of the biggest PFAS manufacturers, has announced it's going to stop making PFAS, you know, because, you know, in part because of, you know, all this state laws and having to pay out so many billions in compensation. And there are thousands more litigation cases and personal injury cases on the docket in the US. So that's going to have more of an impact, I would say, as well, you know, because we only know about this problem about PFAS because of the lawyer Rob Bilott, who was the protagonist in the Dark Waters film. You know, he brought the very first case to trial in 2015 against DuPont on behalf of the people of Parkersburg, West Virginia, who drank the carcinogen PFOA in their drinking water. And, you know, in the first three cases that Rob Bilott brought, DuPont were, you know, held accountable for causing cancer in the people who drank the water, and after that they kind of settled. So, you know, it's that litigation has really kind of blast open the whole story, and it's because of that now you're getting more scientific research, more litigation, more investigations. You know, now you're also having, you know, companies which are coming up and saying, oh, these are making PFAS free products, because there's, you know, they can see obviously there's room in the market as public knowledge grows about how, you know, devastating this pollution problem is. That's again going to pressure, you've got that consumer pressure. So in the US, certain companies have said they're not going to put it in their food packaging anymore in the US. So things are happening, but, you know, it's really kind of incentivized by legislation.
What can we do as individuals and as consumers? One, to kind of limit our exposure, and two, to put more pressure on companies and governments to eradicate PFAS as best they can?
I mean, that's a really difficult question, because PFAS is in so many products, so it's really difficult to avoid it. You can make choices, as in buying that kind of waterproof coat that doesn't have PFAS on it, that will have a different kind of material. So you can make those choices, but you have to sort of put a bit of effort in to work out and find out which ones they are. Some things are marked PFAS-free. Others wouldn't know to say that. So you have to put a bit of effort in yourself. But again, it is, I think, the problem can only be solved by the manufacturers choosing alternatives to PFAS. And one of the arguments that the PFAS lobby uses is there are no alternatives, and, you know, we have to use this, otherwise we can't have renewable energy or electric cars and things like that. But talking to lots of experts, a lot of the claims that the lobby is making that we have to use it in these particular applications is not actually true, that they can be replaced in many, many, many of those. And there might be a few remaining ones where you can't. But the industry has to be honest about where it can be replaced and where it can't. And where it can't be replaced, then there's a whole new business and a world of innovation, and, you know, where people can create new substances and chemicals, and, you know, that will boost the economy rather than the other argument, which is, well, if we can't use them, you're going to lose that industry. So I think industry needs to be really honest and needs to work with the regulators, and the regulators need to be stronger and the laws need to be stronger to say that, you know, you can't put these things out there unless you can prove that it's not going to cause harm, rather than waiting until a few days, decades later, where it's out there in unmeasurable volumes and, you know, creating problems for the environment and for people. Not very hopeful, sorry. No. Not the most upbeat.
No, but as you mentioned, consumers have some power, and yeah, voters also do have some power as well, which is good to hear. Liana, would you add anything to that in terms of advice for individuals?
But it is pretty limited what individuals can do, because it is really ubiquitous. But under the pressure of legislation, for example, there are now fluorine-free firefighting foams. You know, the industry has had to innovate, and, you know, they're already being used at Heathrow Airport. So there are alternatives. But I think if there's enough public awareness, like there has grown over sewage, you know, once people, you know, en masse really know what's going on, that they can really start to, you know, affect for change and push for kind of more effective legislation. So I would say, you know, the public does have a role to play in that way.
Thanks so much, guys, for walking me through all of that and for joining me and trying to make sense of PFAS, the scary world of PFAS that we live in, and giving us a tiny little bit of hope.
Thank you for having us, Josh.
Thanks for watching. If you like videos like this about the impacts of pollution and how it's impacting our health, then please check out this video we made about nanoplastics and how plastic is accumulating in our bodies.